Welcome to Property Litigation Bites by Hargan Wolf, delivering the latest analysis of property litigation trends to UK landowners, developers, landlords, and tenants.
The Renters' Rights Act received royal assent on the 27th of October 2025 after years and years of planning. Obviously, lots of people will have in mind the 1st of May 2026 as the date when things start happening, but actually some things are already happening, and as we'll discuss today, it's time to get yourself in gear and get organised now. So today I'm joined by John Waiting from Exchange Chambers. So today we're going to be looking at the Renters Rights Act implementation and discussing when and what. If you had to give one piece of advice to everybody, if they're going to switch off after this, what would it be?
Well, I think the piece of advice would be assess now where you're at and work out if you do want your property back if you are a landlord under the old regime, which will probably be easier for you. And that is by serving a Section 21 notice, because that window is now closing. You've got until the 30th of April to do so. But really, given the hoops that you might need to jump through in order to serve that notice, unless you want to miss that deadline, I would be thinking about it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the 1st of May, which is when the phase one comes into force, it will creep upon people a lot sooner than they expect. But that's in the future. We'll have a quick look back at the past. So as I said, the Renters' Rights Act got royal assent on the 27th of October 2025, and there's one bit of legislation, or one bit of it already in place, which is the Local Authorities' Investigatory Powers, which came into force on the 27th of December 2025, which means the last day for serving a Section 21 notice is going to be the 30th of April 2026, ahead of a whole glut of reforms coming in on the 1st of May 2026. That includes the abolishment of ASTs, the abolishment of the Section 21 no reason evictions, instead being replaced by a much wider regime of Section 8. And there are also going to be additional provisions related to things such as rent increases, rent bidding, pets, children, discrimination, and enforcement powers. Shortly after that, by the 31st of May 2026, there will be a requirement for all landlords to provide their tenants with an information sheet. And that information sheet hasn't yet been published. They're looking to do that by some point in March. And for those that have got themselves in gear and served a Section 21 notice, the deadline for issuing court proceedings based on that notice will be the 31st of July 2026. Now, John, do you want to talk us through some of these reforms, such as the abolishment of ASTs and the abolishment of Section 21?
From a layperson's point of view, so not thinking about this as lawyers, but I think many people who listen to this won't be lawyers and therefore won't be thinking in the technical terms. But Section 2 of the Act abolishes assured shorthold tenancies, and Section 1 of the Act makes every tenancy to be a periodic tenancy of a month or shorter. Now, what's that really mean? Well, it means that you move from this system where you might have a fixed tenancy for 12 months and then it moves to a statutory periodic tenancy, to everything being a rolling tenancy. So a tenancy which is from month to month, but can only be brought to an end if certain conditions are met. So the second big change is the government would say that the abolition of assured shorthold tenancies means the end of no-fault evictions under Section 21. And that phrase, no-fault eviction, is quite emotive, because it's a tenant who is living in a house quite nicely, paying their rent. Their tenancy can still be brought to an end under Section 21, or it used to be, without any fault on their part. And that will necessarily end under these reforms. However, I think it's wrong to say that there will be an end to no-fault evictions, because what we will see in a second is that there are grounds for eviction which still aren't the fault of the tenant, but nonetheless will allow the landlord to bring the tenancy to an end. So I'd put it a different way and say it's an end to no reason evictions. Now, as long as the landlord can bring themselves under some of these new grounds, they can still bring these tenancy to an end. From the tenant's point of view, they will now have to give 2 months' notice to bring this rolling tenancy to an end. So that's the tenant's side. Thinking about the landlord's side, there are changes to the grounds, and there are a lot more grounds now than we had before. But I'm not going to take you through every single one of those grounds. I'm only going to pick out the main ones and the main changes that people might have be interested in. And as with all these things, if when this does come in, you will probably want to take advice if you did want to bring a tenancy to an end. But looking at the grounds, the new or amended grounds, ground one is occupation by the landlord or their family. So the landlord wants the property back in order that they can live there or their family can live there. Now, this was there under the old law, but it only applied if a notice had been served before the tenancy had begun. So this is quite a big change, because it means that if that notice isn't served, it can still be relied upon. Now, it's going to be a 4-month notice period, and it can only be given after the first anniversary of the tenancy. So whilst there isn't that fixed term, you still have to wait 12 months of this rolling period in order to serve, to rely on this notice. Now, the old law, it was quite narrow. It was limited to the landlord or their spouse or civil partner. Now, the new law widens that out quite a lot, and it allows it to be relied on for the occupation of the landlord, a spouse or civil partner, a person who lives with the landlord as if they were married or were in a civil partnership, a grandchild, a child of any of those people we have talked of, siblings, parents and grandparents of the landlord, and you treat half blood as full blood. So that vastly widens the people who can move into the property if one of these notices are served. But the crucial point is, it has to be used as the only or principal home of this person. And if possession is obtained on the back of this notice, it cannot be relet. The property can't be relet to somebody who is outside of that class of people. So a new tenancy with a third party from 12 months from the notice. And there are penalties which are going to apply if that is abused. So that's something to watch. So now a new ground 1A, is the sale of the dwelling house. So the tenancy has to be a year old, or there has to be a compulsory purchase order. Again, it's 4 months notice, and the landlord needs to either intend to sell it or to grant a lease of more than 21 years. And then you have the same rule again, that if you get it back, you can't relet it for 12 months. From the service of the notice. And again, that is to protect the tenants from these grounds being abused by landlords who will try and take the property back and then relet. Again, there is no need for there to be a notice pre-tenancy. I'm now going to talk about rent arrears, which is probably going to be the main ground still of a fault ground of people, landlords trying to get their properties back by taking possession. Now, it's going to be similar to what we have before, but the periods of arrears, or the amount of arrears which is going to be required in order to have a mandatory ground of possession, are going to increase. So, for example, if rent is paid weekly or fortnightly, 13 weeks rent is going to need to be in arrears in order to rely on the mandatory ground. And that's an increase from 8. And then if rent is payable monthly, and most tenancies really, I think, will be monthly rents, or most we see are monthly rents, these will be an increase from 2 months arrears to 3 months arrears. So that's a bit more friendly to the tenants. Because of the changes to assured short hard tenancies, we're not in a situation anymore where rent can be paid quarterly or yearly. So that's gone. So all of these changes to the grounds are slightly more favourable to the tenants. Now, the notice periods in relation to this are 4 weeks, beginning with the date of the service of the notice. So in relation to rent, this is up from 2 weeks. So you can see that you've moved from this situation where you would have had 2 months arrears plus a 2 week notice, 10 weeks, and then possession proceedings can begin. Now you've got the 3 months of arrears and a 4 week notice period. So effectively a 4 month wait. And from a landlord's point of view, some of them take the view that once a tenant has missed a payment, well, that's a risk. And some landlords take the view, well, I'm going to really watch this and I'll want possession. I think here now, the message from the government is you've got to give the tenants a leeway here. And that is going to give the tenants an opportunity to get back on track. And hopefully, I think one of my main themes in thinking about these reforms is most landlords are good landlords, most tenants are good tenants. And if you have a good tenant, skipping to the end, don't worry about any of these changes, because a good tenant is still a good tenant. And I wouldn't be rushing to serve a Section 21 notice. I know we've just said, if you want to serve a Section 21 notice, serve it by the 30th of April, fine. But really think about that, because if you've got a good tenant, these changes are firstly inevitable, but secondly, don't really change anything. It extends the periods, but that is now going to be a fact of life. And I think what I would say to landlords, and we'll come to this in relation to rent increases and the like, is really value your good tenant. Because what me and Philip will see is that when you have a bad tenant, that's when, as a landlord, that causes you real difficulty. So anyway, that's the changes to rent. And I think that's also a warning to people to say, don't make any knee-jerk reactions on the back of this legislation.
No, and I think you're right. I think landlords will just need to be maybe a little bit more hands-on with their portfolios, a little bit more aware, because, you know, the grounds are increasing. So there's currently 17 grounds under Section 8, and that's going to be 37. So there's a wider range, as you've said, John, of grounds to evict tenants. The issue is it's going to take a little bit longer, and therefore landlords will need to plan accordingly, especially as you've said, if landlords are looking to sell part of their portfolio with vacant possession, it's going to take time and they're going to need to plan for that. Now, in the run-up to the Renters' Rights Act, which for those with longer memories will remember used to be a Conservative bill, so it survived a change of government to some degree. There was a lot of issues, a lot of concern about student lettings. Now, that's been dealt with in the Renters' Rights Act. And there's a new ground called Ground 4A, which applies to student HMOs, which is a three or more students in what we would term digs. What it means is that the landlord can serve notice during the summer months, giving the tenants 4 months notice to leave, as long as they are letting the property again to more students. Now, that will keep the turnover of traditional student lettings, will keep that ticking over. But there's no changes to the purpose-built student accommodation, which is already outside of the Housing Act and is therefore outside of the Renters' Rights Act. So that's your student halls built and run by the education provider. And a student non-HMO will be dealt with as any other tenancy. But as you discussed, John, a lot of the changes to possession grounds are going to be deemed to be tenant-friendly. But there's some other reforms, aren't there, that will assist tenants, such as related to rent. Do you want to just talk us through that?
Yes. So in relation to rent increases, I think some landlords under the old law basically would put a new rent to their tenant, and if their tenant didn't accept it, would effectively serve them with a Section 21 notice. And it became almost inevitable, and the tenant would probably have to agree to the rent increases. And that was the practice for a certain number of landlords and letting agencies. Now, with the coming to an end of assured shorthold tenancies, that's not possible anymore. And whilst there used to be a mechanism in order to deal with rent increases, that is now really going to be the only way. And Section 13 and 14 of the Housing Act 1988, which is amended by Section 6 and 7 of the new Act, bring in that mechanism. Now, the way it's going to work is after the first anniversary of the tenancy, so again, you've got that, it's got to run for 12 months, the landlord can give 2 months' notice to increase the rent. And the tenant can challenge this. And if there is a disagreement and it can't come to an agreed solution, it ends up in the first tier tribunal. Now, the way it will work is that the landlord will have to suggest a rent in their notice. And the tribunal will have to work out what the open market rent will be or is of that property. Now, if that figure exceeds the number that the landlord proposed, the landlord is still stuck with the figure that they put in their notice. Whereas if it is lower, the rent will be that lower market rate. So if the open market rate is lower than what the landlord's put in the notice, it is what the open market rate is. There are two kind of procedural points to note here. Firstly, because we're in the first tier tribunal, there aren't any costs unless there's been unreasonable behaviour. And secondly, that the rent increase takes place if it goes to tribunal from the date of the tribunal decision or a later date that the tribunal might direct. Now, if I am a tenant, I am thinking, well, almost I might as well challenge the rent increase because it will at least put back the date from which the new rent comes in, even if actually I don't manage to challenge the rent properly and get it down from what the landlord has put in their notice. So that will be interesting to see whether that knowledge effectively is disseminated between tenants and people know to do it and that they do just put in their notice. And secondly, the attitude of the tribunal, because I would have thought that the tribunal will want to try and do as many of these on paper. They're not really, I don't think they're going to think, well, we're going to list lots of hearings in order to do this because it will just be swamped. I note that in the government's papers that they've put out in relation to this, they have talked about actually moving this out of the tribunal system, this mechanism, and having some kind of adjudicator in order that this isn't swamping the tribunal. And if it becomes common knowledge that you can avoid a rent increase or you can delay a rent increase just by putting in your notice and looking at what other rents are and with not really a huge amount of work to do, it could swamp the tribunal. And on that basis, I would expect the government to move it out into some kind of adjudication paper process.
But surely, John, even if the government does do something to move the rent reviews out of the tribunal, for example, pass that function to the ombudsman, which we'll discuss shortly, isn't there a risk, given that there is no seeming downside to tenants in asking for a rent review, that it will just merely swamp the ombudsman instead?
Well, firstly, I think it's just about resources. If enough resources are given to whoever is dealing with it, then it won't be a problem. Now, it's whether the government will do that or not. But I suppose the whole tenet of the Renters' Rights Act is that tenants shouldn't be punished for being tenants. And if I think the government have taken the view that they don't want to have a disincentive to making what should be a fairly straightforward application, say, no, my rent shouldn't go up. So like all of the Renters' Rights Act, I think they probably considered that and gone, actually, we don't want there to be a disincentive.
And on enforcement and penalties and sanctions, there's going to be changes there, aren't there? So changes both at the tribunal in relation to rent repayment orders, but also additional powers and civil penalties from local authorities.
Yes, the local authorities are going to be given much wider investigatory power and the ability to levy civil penalties. I think what's quite interesting in relation to the local authorities is that they are going to be able to, in certain circumstances, enforce outside of their area. So they're not necessarily going to be limited to their geographical area. Now, that certain procedures have to be taken into account if they're going to do that. But I also note that the income received from civil penalties must be used by the local authorities, pumped back into their housing function in order to meet the costs and expenses incurred and associated in the private rented sector. So one might see that a enterprising local authority or somebody who has a good selection of housing officers and lawyers, they expand their geographical remit. The fines that they use are pumped back in order to improve their service in enforcement of these new rules. And it will be interesting to see how that manifests itself, whether you have a local authority who is enterprising and really expands and effectively funds itself, funds its function by going out into other authorities and enforcing, or whether what you might get is all the authorities in a local area effectively coming in together and saying, right, well, we will have this function together and we will initially fund it. And there is some seed funding already from central government together. And then we'll have some kind of agreement about how we go about enforcing. And then effectively we will pool what we get back from the civil penalties in order to have that function improved. So it will be interesting to see how that shakes out. So again, that's a watch this space scenario. But if you are a landlord or a letting agent, the thing to bear in mind is these powers are there. You could be served with a notice. That notice might require you to pay thousands of pounds. So don't assume that the local authorities are going to be ineffective. I would assume that the local authorities are going to be effective and get your house in order with all these matters so that what will happen to some landlords is they will stick their heads in the sand. They won't appreciate or will ignore. They'll either not realise these matters have come into force or they'll ignore them and then they will come a cropper. And if that's you, you want to avoid that.
And those powers are separate to the rent repayment orders, aren't they?
Yes, the rent repayment orders, we already have them in relation to some circumstances in relation to HMOs. And you also kind of have it in relation to the tenancy deposit regime where you might get an order that you repay 1 to 3 times the deposit if you don't protect it. But their rent repayment orders, which are section 102 to 113 of the new acts, it's much broader now, the area in which a landlord can be ordered to repay the rent to the tenant. And I suppose the point is that if you have a high rent, you know, a few months' rent can be a serious amount of money. Or if something has gone on for a long time, you know, that might soon mount up. So in relation to rent repayment orders, again, this is something where you don't want to be, as a landlord, ignorant of these new requirements and laws, because it could get very expensive. What I would say is you can't just say it's business as normal. You need to at least have a look at what is now required of you as a landlord and go through and check that you are doing all these matters.
Thanks for that, John. So that was phase one, which is coming in on the 1st of May. But after that, there'll be two more phases, one in the near future and one in the distant future. So phase two, which is starting, they say, in late 2026, and in reality will be going on towards 2028, is in two phases, the database sign-up and the ombudsman. Now, the database is a brand new private rented sector database. It will allow tenants to have access to information and documents regarding their rights and regarding their tenancies. It will also help landlords understand these obligations that John's discussed. And it will also be used by the councils, the local authorities, as part of their enforcement activity, because it's going to be mandatory for landlords to sign up and there will be a fee payable.
Yeah, in relation to the database, I just hope that the government get it right. I remember a time when the government's websites didn't really add up and they were quite difficult to use. And if one compares, for example, the old web check service on Companies House to what we have now, which is quite user-friendly and searchable, I would hope that they get it right in such a way that, firstly, it's easy for landlords to understand their obligations and that they do make it into a one-stop shop where a landlord can effectively use it as a checklist and say, well, I've done that, I'm okay. And also, I would hope it would have a very lay version of what the law is, because not all landlords want to go to lawyers if they're doing something which is fairly straightforward. But on the same side, I hope it's going to be helpful for tenants. And one of the points on there is that if there are any decisions which have been made against the landlord, they're going to be recorded against the landlord's entry, I suppose it would be, on that database. And then a tenant can look up the landlord and work out whether actually they would want to take a tenancy from this person. But the data is only as good as what's been fed in. And as what we can see with Companies House, is that they don't audit the data as it comes in, and it just puts out and what the person has registered on Companies House. Now, that could happen as well with the landlords. But what I would note is that in relation to the database, it's going to be one of these matters that if you're as a landlord, you are reckless or you fraudulently upload information to the database, that is going to be one of these areas where there could either be a rent repayment order or an enforcement notice. So I think the landlords, as I said before, most landlords are good landlords, most tenants are good tenants. The good landlords will just comply. And the question is what will the bad landlords do? And if the bad landlords aren't uploading information correctly, to what extent will the government have funded their enforcement powers that there will be a comeuppance for these landlords? So it will all be about implementation at the end of the day.
And there'll also be, as part of phase two, the new ombudsman, the landlord redress scheme, as they're calling it. Sign up will be 2026, but it won't actually be implemented itself until 2028. The ombudsman, obviously, will wait and see what they're going to do. But in reality, they're going to be forcing apologies and giving compensation to tenants for breaches by landlords. Phase three is even longer in the future. John, do you want to talk us through that and tell us when, if ever, that will happen?
So there's two elements to phase three. There's the Decent Home Standard and there's AWOP's Law. Now, we already see AWOP's Law in the social sector, and that's really about responding quickly to a set number of prescribed hazards. And it comes from the sad story where a child who lived with mold died. And nobody would want people to live in housing like that. So AWOP's Law is about dealing quickly and effectively with hazards. And there is a prescribed hazards that one would need to comply with. But putting aside that, if you are a landlord and a family comes to you, or even, not so family, a tenant comes to you and says, look, there's mold here, you've still got to deal with it under the disrepair laws. So yes, it is more, there's greater enforcement and creates greater knowledge and impetus for landlords to do things. But going back to my overriding point of, if you're going to be a landlord, be a good landlord, you need to deal with these things anyway. The Decent Home Standard is a bit more ethereal, and effectively, it's going to be a standard at which every home has to meet. But I suppose the point is that even now, they're only beginning to consult on what that standard might be, and standards of housing varies hugely throughout the country. And the implementation date or the hoped implementation date of this is between 2035 and 2037. And when I read that, I thought it was a misprint, because I thought, well, that is so far in the future as to almost be never, because you might have change of governments or change of attitudes. And it's just so long in the future that I wouldn't worry about it at this stage. However, if you are a landlord and there is a consultation on it, you might want to get involved in the consultation. But either way, disrepair is a huge thing in housing, and disrepair claims are very common. And I think it all comes down to all of these changes. If you are a landlord, two things. Firstly, having your systems in place, not assuming this property will just look after itself. Checking back in, making sure that you have good systems so that actually you have complied with all these elements. And the second point about it's no good having good systems if you can't evidence those systems. So not only do you want to have good systems, is you want to have good record keeping and make sure you have all the evidence that you might need should a tenant bring a claim against you, should the local authority knock on your door and say, have you complied with this? Because if you do that, if you have good systems and you have good evidence, that should mean that your property is being kept in good condition and there won't be a claim. But if there is a claim, you have the evidence in order to defend it. The difficulty we have sometimes is where a landlord, if we're defending a disrepair claim, for example, is a landlord says, well, I had this conversation or I did this, but there really isn't any evidence of it. And once you get to court, it's really about what you can prove.
Thanks, John. Lots to consider there. I think for me, the main takeaways are for tenants, you'll have more protections, especially in relation to challenging rent reviews. For landlords, this is not the end of being able to evict tenants. It will be more difficult and it will be slower, but you will still be able to evict. And there will be a wider range of grounds under Section 8 to allow you to evict, especially if you're, e.g., selling the house or occupying the house. John, any final thoughts from you?
Yes. The Renters' Rights Act is coming in. So if you are a landlord, you need to get on top of it now, work out what your obligations are, work out if there's anything which might mean that you are potentially in breach, and fix it. And document that you fixed it.
Well, thank you, John, for your time today. And thank you to everyone who listened. If anyone who's out there needs any help serving Section 21 notices or has any queries about the roadmap for the Renters' Rights Act, please feel free to reach out to Hargan Wolf via LinkedIn or email us at hello@harganwolf.co.uk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Property Litigation Bites. Hargan Wolf is an award-winning UK law firm specialising exclusively in property litigation and disputes. If you would like to discuss any of the issues covered in this episode, please contact us at hello@harganwolf.co.uk. You can also find us on LinkedIn. Visit www.harganwolf.co.uk for further insight and analysis.